Good evening. My name is Joe Cronin. I'm with Lipman, Frizzell & Mitchell. We're real estate appraisers and consultants out of Columbia, Maryland. I've done a fair amount of work in Maryland, Delaware, and the Mid-Atlantic, and am familiar with a lot of issues in Sussex County. My firm was retained to do a market feasibility analysis for the proposed development. Full report is contained in tab number 24 of the monster text that you've been given tonight. And I'll just hit a couple of the high points in the interest of time. Real estate economics is really a simple matter, as we all remember from Economics 101 and college. You've got demand and you've got supply. And you try to look at what the demand is and see how the supply matches up with that, and you try to determine whether a project is going to be successful or not. That's the simple nature of my job. I try to complicate it as much as possible by using a lot of statistics. Okay. Nonetheless, I'm sure that the council is very familiar with the high growth, profile of Sussex County. There's tremendous demand out there for living in the quality environment that you all have. So you can see that there's strong population and household growth in Sussex County at a rate that's almost double the rest of the state. Residential market trends on the supply side. So there were almost 3,900 multiple list sales in 2006, and that was, as far as the real estate business is concerned, as you all know, not a good year, okay? So we've got a very strong real estate market, even in an off year as far as the overall real estate economy is concerned. Homes during 2006 spent an average of 80 days on the market, less than 3 months. The median home price in Sussex County, about $246,000. The median home price, in other words, half of the house prices above and half of the house prices below, about $257,000 in the town of Milton. So we've got a very active real estate market, and we've got good home values that are presented in the general environment. New home sales. So, again, getting away from the existing home sales that we just talked about, one aspect of activity in the market. New home sales. These are new subdivisions that are selling in Sussex County. As things are right now, you can see that in terms of currently selling communities, about 59 communities have single-family homes, about 36 communities are selling right now that have townhomes, and about 12 are selling that have multifamily homes. Next on the table there are the total number of units planned. We can see that there is substantial planned supply in Sussex County. We try to take that into account. Almost 17,000 units are planned in the communities that we're talking about here. Okay. Within that number of units that are planned, though, in those subdivisions, this is the number of units that have been sold already from within those subdivisions as of about November 06, the latest data that we have available. That totals about 5,400 units have been sold already out of the approximately 17,000 that were, in planning total. And remaining inventory, we've got a significant remaining inventory. Almost 7,000 single-family detached homes, about 1,800 single-family townhomes, and about less than 3,000 multifamily units. So again, we're aware that there's a significant supply out there as far as existing subdivisions that are up and selling already. Next, looking at future supply, there's an estimated 7,000 to 8,000 units in various stages of pre-development in this portion of Sussex County. So we've also taken that into account. In terms of new home demand, Libman, Frizzell, and Mitchell's estimate is that within Sussex County, there's demand on an annual basis as we go ahead for 1,200 to 1,260 single-family detached homes a year, about 1,000 townhomes a year, and 300 to 360 condo units a year. So, in other words, a total of about 2,500, 2,600 homes a year on average for the foreseeable future. Okay, this is the growth path that Sussex County is on, and I'm sure that you're all aware of it, having approved most of it. What does this mean for the villages of Elizabethtown? In our opinion, first of all, the villages of Elizabethtown has the potential to create its own destination type of residential community with a good scale, amenity package, and other things that are excellent predictors of good sales. The majority of buyers are likely to be active adults, okay? I happen to be one of them. And maybe someday, you know, Darren will be able to talk me into buying one of the homes here. But a lot of the buyers are going to be folks either nearing retirement or already retirees. We recommend that the marketing effort include a model home park as a marketing effort and a first-class sales approach with either four national type of builders who bring their own marketing or four different price points and product types that are available at any given time. For selling out a major development like this, you can't just be selling one product all the time. You have to be able to market to pretty much anybody who comes to your model home park. You want to be able to offer homes in a variety of styles and price ranges. We believe that the amenities planned within the community have to be delivered as early as possible in order to make a good sale to people based on the quality of the community. The pricing in the community has to be competitive. We believe that it will be based on everything that we've seen so far, and that this property will sell at a pace of about 20 units a month over the long term. Okay, and we estimate that the absorption period for the villages of Elizabethtown is about 15 years. So that is in brief summary form the market analysis that we've done for villages of Elizabethtown. And at this time, I'd like to introduce Molly McKay of ERA, who's done the fiscal analysis.
Good evening.
Excuse me.
My name is Molly McKay, and I'm with Economics Research Associates. I am a senior associate with ERA, and we hail from 1101 Connecticut Avenue, Washington, D.C. I have a master's degree in international politics and economics with additional postgraduate studies at Johns Hopkins Real Estate Finance Program. And I've been in the urban planning and development business for 15 years. The entirety of that time has been spent in Washington, D.C. I'd also like to add that I spent a good part of the beginning of my work in municipal management with the International City County Management Association and the Urban Land Institute. And I only share that with you just to point out that I take municipal management very seriously. I'm here tonight to walk you through our preliminary findings with the fiscal and economic benefits associated with the Elizabethtown project. And I'm going to share with you a lot of numbers, and I wanted to take a little bit of time to walk you through our methodology and approach to help you to understand that our analysis is based on the program planning concepts that have been developed to date. We consider the fiscal and economic impact testing process to be a collaborative and iterative process. We rely very heavily on the entirety of the team, as well as collaboration with county officials. To date, we have interviewed Mrs. Susan Webb, the Director of Finance, as well as officials from the Cape Henlopen School District. And we will continue to collect data and assumptions as this project continues to continue to refine our analysis as more information becomes available. And I point that out because this fiscal impact analysis is really the assemblage of more than 100 demographic and economic variables. And as such, it is really, I would consider it a work in progress that will rely heavily upon the program factors as this project continues to evolve. As a starting point, ERA evaluated the program, the development program, to get our hands on exactly what kinds of unit types would be envisioned to better understand the types of households that would be living there. This is very important because it, in effect, it will inform the values that we apply to these different unit types to help understand what the potential assessed values would be for calculating property taxes and other tax and fee revenues. That also applies to the commercial program. On to the next slide. This project is expected to generate significant one-time and annual ongoing fiscal and economic benefits. The fiscal benefits that we are here to share with you tonight are we'll follow after I go over some of the economic benefits, which primarily relate to the total project investment, which we consider to be significant. Over the life of the project, at build-out, we expect the construction-related investment to equate to approximately $860 million. That's split between hard construction purchases, which are likely to be in the range of $558 million, as well as soft costs associated with consultants, engineering, millwork, the like, in the range of $300 million. Breaking out construction materials, we're able to isolate one-time direct benefits associated with the project being primarily construction wages and material purchases within the local area. Based on an average construction wage, we would anticipate over the life of the project that the construction wages could translate to approximately 950 construction jobs. And if you divide by, say, a 10-year build-out or a 15-year build-out, you're able to then derive what the annual employment would be. Another one-time benefit that we've isolated would be the one-time realty transfer taxes. We would envision as the homes are built out and sold over the life of the project, the county would accrue approximately $27 million in realty transfer taxes. Again, that's spread out over a 10 to 15-year build-out, but based on the targeted sales prices for those units, we would consider that to be a significant benefit to the county. Moving on to the ongoing annual benefits, at this time, we've been able to identify real property taxes, and then ongoing realty transfer taxes as the properties are expected to be sold again over time. And based on our analysis and our understanding of the county's assessment process, we would value the real property taxes to equal $4.4 million at build-out. And again, that's annual ongoing, and that's for all taxes. That would be both county and school and school vocational taxes. In addition to the fiscal benefits, the project is expected to generate significant economic benefits in the form of on-site direct jobs. The commercial program is expected to support 750 full-time retail equivalents and approximately 411 commercial jobs. Again, that's direct on-site. I wanted to just take a moment also in discussing the fiscal benefits to highlight that we have analyzed the Sussex County General Fund budget, and we have identified the top five county general fund revenue sources being first the realty transfer tax, which is included in our analysis, the real property tax also included. In addition, the project is expected to generate other benefits that we haven't been able to quantify to date, being recorder of deeds taxes and building inspection fees. And finally, I'd like to mention that one of the top five general fund revenue sources is also from the state of Delaware, being the state paramedic program contribution. And we're still in the process of trying to understand exactly how those revenues are transferred in and the extent to which an increase in population might also generate additional intergovernmental transfers to the locality. Moving on to the demographic implications of this project, we've also analyzed the related residential inflows that could be associated with this project. And based on a variable household size, according to each of the unit types, we estimate that at project build-out, again, that's at the end of perhaps 15 years of build-out, that the project would generate an additional 8,455 residents, again, 3,710 residential units. We rely on this demographic analysis to help inform our analysis of the potential school impacts. Again, we did interview with the Cape Henlopen School District, and I'd like to mention again that we're continuing to refine our research regarding this portion of our analysis. But to date, what we've been able to ascertain is that based on a range of student generation factors for each of the unit types envisioned, between zero students for the age-restricted units to 0.43 students per household could be generated by this project. And these assumptions were derived by first relying upon a school generation report, an analysis that was conducted by Dr. Brandon Berger. I believe that's already part of the record. Is that right? Yes, I thought so. And also some additional analysis that ERA has conducted. And this table here, it illustrates the impact of a variable household size and unit type on a range of student generation factors. And we've compared those factors to the state level plus student generation factors that had been provided to us in comments earlier, just to demonstrate that the state level plus student generation factor at 0.49, it's slightly higher than the student generation factors that we've employed in our analysis, but given the unit types that are envisioned and the variable household types and household formation types, we believe that our student generation factors are more appropriate for facility planning purposes. Okay, based on those analyses I've just shared with you, we developed a budget analysis to try to isolate the costs that would be borne by the Cape Henlopen School District as a local entity. And also, we have developed a range of student generation potentials by scenario just to to better illustrate that if the project were to achieve 60% active adults versus 100% market rate residents, which would be just open to anyone, any family type, but assuming that 100% market rate project would have a higher propensity to generate children, the project could generate anywhere between 583 to 1,419 students. Again, that's at build-out. That's at the end of, say, 15 years, and those students are spread out between kindergarten through 12th grade. So it's not as if in year one you're all of a sudden going to have 1,400 students hitting a high school or anything like that. But it, I think, helps to illustrate that with a traditional new urbanism development community, it is possible to have a lower student generation yield than with some, I'd say, typical suburban sprawl type developments.
What was that again?
There you go. You heard it.
No, I know. I just don't believe it. What did you say again? You just repeat that again. You were stumbling a little bit, and I was
trying to understand what I was saying.
I was having a hard time following.
Well, I was trying to illustrate here the potential.
This kind of development, because it's so big and so compact, will have less students than scattered sites.
If this project were to have a higher propensity or a higher proportion, I should say, of active adult families without children, it would generate fewer students.
The key word was if. Right, okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes.
Okay. So based on our analysis and a cost per pupil that has been calculated to represent just the local cost, so we've stripped out costs that would be borne by state and federal funding based on our analysis of the Cape Henlopen school budget. We estimate that between 994 and $2.4 million per year would be the cost of this development to the school district. Finally, I wanted to move on to the public safety benefits of this project. We believe that this project does present some very important public realm benefits in the form of, first, the contribution of land and construction investment for a dedicated public safety building. The project will maintain dedicated 24-hour private security force to help with public safety and emergency services. And residents are expected to contribute approximately $100 per household annually to support the volunteer fire department's annual operating costs at a value of $370,000 at build-out. And finally, as I mentioned, we are still working on isolating exactly the extent to which state-level funding can help to support municipal services here. But we would anticipate that the state of Delaware would continue to provide public safety funds to help offset emergency preparedness funds through via intergovernmental transfers and other. So with that, I think I'll turn this over to John Pardee.
Okay, thank you for your patience so far. We're going to try and wrap this up very quickly for you. I wanted to point out for the record and for the benefit of your council that we have provided in the notebook some proposed findings and conditions. Those are at tab 26. If I may briefly run through our conclusion and ask Mr. Arndt to come forward with some closing remarks, then we'll be happy to entertain whatever questions you might have. I wanted to point out in conclusion six critical points. First, this application in its entirety complies with your own comprehensive plan. Second, as proposed, the project will comply with all of your county code requirements. Third, it is enthusiastically supported by the Office of State Planning Coordination. Fourth,
We have satisfactorily addressed all of the PLUS comments, and those comments and our responses are included in your notebook. Fifth, the project brings a number of benefits to the town of Milton, and we submit will result in a great net positive benefit. And if you think about that, this project provides much-needed infrastructure, which the town, if it proceeded with its own comprehensive plan proposal, we believe couldn't possibly provide, and we're doing that at no cost to the town whatsoever. We're intending on respecting the existing heritage of the area in its entirety, and this project would bring people, businesses, and services to the area that we submit would revitalize and produce a net positive benefit not only to the area and the community but to the town of Milton as well. Finally, the project is, in fact, a model community as envisioned by Livable Delaware, and I'd like to have Mr. Arndt give you just a little bit more on that, and then we'll be done.
Randall Arndt back just for a little summing up. I think this really is the epitome of what smart growth is about. Livable Delaware has been talking about this for years. It is entirely consistent with state, county, and town locational criteria. It's a true mixed-use community where people have a very short drive to shops or a short bike ride or a nice walk, 8.6 miles of trails, 37 miles of sidewalks in addition to that, 270 acres of parkland, 1,800 acres of preserved farmland. Total open space is about 70% when one includes the total 2,500 acres, but a very respectable 35% open space within the 750 acres of developed area. 400 units of house of moderately priced housing units, badly needed. And you know, obviously, the a key solution to a pressing, long-standing, very serious environmental problem in sewage capacity in the town of Milton would be solved in one fell swoop, in an environmentally sensitive way, supported by the Department of Agriculture as spray irrigation on the farmland. All the woodlands on the property have been preserved, including the upland woods, which are typically, I know from experience, very often leveled by developers and with impunity because there are no rules against taking out woods as long as the woods are flat, dry, buildable land. I think in every score that you look at this, whether it's the neighborhood greens, the trails, the school site, the fire department site, the church site, the retail, the services, healthcare facility potential, the perimeter buffers, the entire design, I think it really does sum up Livable Delaware. And it would be the poster child, I think, in the state of Delaware for how to do a great project in the right place. Many times one sees projects like this near Fredericksburg, Virginia. 12 years ago, one was proposed called Haymount, but it was not near Fredericksburg, really. It was like 10 miles away. And people said, that is the right project in the wrong place. This, I think, is the right project in the right place. And it's rare that you find conservation design and new urbanism that come together. And it's even rarer that you find conservation design and new urbanism coming together in a place where the state, the county, and the town say that's where it ought to be. I think this is an absolutely unique opportunity, and I've been very pleased to be a part of the design process throughout. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. President, at this time we'd be happy to entertain whatever questions you might have.
I've got a couple questions.
Well, I've got a suggestion. Why don't we listen to the opposition, then hit questions, because if we get carried away, the opposition could sit there for quite a while. And if that's agreeable, then we can ask.
Well, the only problem with that, if we do that, is that after you ask questions of the applicant, then we've got to go back and give the anyone who's here in opposition an opportunity to respond. And typically, we allow the applicant to present and then allow.
Whatever. I was just trying to. I've got quite a few. Let me see. let me. I don't know where to start at the begin, the end. Where I mean, Randall just mentioned the 1,700 acres of farmland are being preserved. They're already preserved, correct? You're not preserving them through this process. This application doesn't preserve any farmland. The farmland you're using for spray irrigation is already in farmland preservation. Is that correct?
The spray irrigation fields, yes, sir. That's correct. I think what he was speaking to is the forested areas that could be built upon that are being preserved.
Where is that?
On the development site area, the 735 acres.
He had referred to 1,700 plus acres that are preserved farmland. I think he's referring to the farmland preservation land that's already preserved. So, right?
I'm not sure that all of that. Brian, do you know?
Yeah, I think the project team has.
State your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Brian Carball from Artesian Resources. The project team has looked at the use of the already preserved ag land preservation as an enhancement of that preservation. It provides additional use, additional income to that ag land preservation land, enhancing its preservation status. And
It's already preserved.
It is preserved,
right,
although okay. The ag land preservation does allow the possibility of buyout, although the property owner has no considerations of this. This puts further use and perpetual restrictions on it for wastewater management. So it's considered an added level of preservation, I think is what Mr. Arnett is referring
okay.
to.
They use the word perpetuity too, right?
That's correct, yes.
On the I guess it was ERA, Molly, I remember that, I wrote that down. The $100 per house for the fire department, where'd you get that number from? Is there a requirement that they're going to give $100 per household per year?
Rogers.
No, I'm just asking.
That's our proposal.
You have proposed that. Has anything
yes,
been accepted? Is it in your finding or conditions here or anything?
No one has dictated that to us, but that is our intention.
Basically conceptual or something.
It's our plan. Yes, sir. It's our proposal. No one has dictated that to us.
And it can't be part of our proposal because it would be contract zoning.
Well, whatever. I'm just trying to figure out. I hear that number. It's a great number. I don't know if anywhere in Sussex County gives that kind of giving, but there's nothing requiring you to do that. It does sound good tonight. I will say that. All right. On a lot of your analysis on the students and all that stuff, it sounded to me just like a bunch of guessing. Is that pretty much it?
Actually, I believe it's, if I may, and Molly may want to follow up on this, I believe it's based on statistical study from
okay.
the doctor that she mentioned.
Okay, 1,400 students, is that what you said, the potential? You didn't look at any of the other, the cumulative effect of all the development we're having in the Milton area? That's just 1,400 from this subdivision, correct? You didn't look? School district wasn't concerned. Was there any concerns from the school district when you got some statistics from them, or you were doing this? What did you say you were having a conversation with the school district?
Are they here?
Molly may want to come forward. I believe, Mr. Cole, that during the conversation, and I'll let Molly answer directly, that they did not express any serious concern about our ability to handle the school impacts. And as Molly testified, it's 1,400 over the period of the project. It's a very gradual, and that's it final build out. But we're confident that with the additional revenues the project will generate, it will more than offset any school impacts. And in fact, the presentation demonstrated, I think, that it's a net positive impact to the school district.
Okay, but I'm just concerned about there's so much development been approved in this area that we saw the other gentleman talk about. That nobody really looked at the cumulative effect on the school district.
That's correct, okay. sir. Our numbers bear out only the impact that our project would have.
Is the retail, my opinion, and I would think most people would think that the retail's excessive for this size of development?
Well, we don't believe so, actually. It's 413,000 square feet for 3,710 units. And
that's about the size. That's probably as much as all of downtown Milton has.
Well, we hope
I bet it's more.
I think you're correct about that, and we hope that the town of Milton will see the benefit as well as the residents of our community.
So that was another question. You separated out the commercial from the RPC?
Yes, sir, that's correct. You have four.
Why?
Well, your code requires it. We have four separate rezoning applications, and the commercial has to be segregated by your ordinance. The part of the property that we're proposing for commercial has to be zone C1, and we're just following your code.
It has to be, right, Lawrence?
No.
No?
You could have 1 acre per 100 units of B1, not C1.
Well, I think what we're saying is that we can't put the commercial in the residential, in residentially zoned property, not the commercial that we're proposing.
Okay, in the RPC you can, I think. But anyway, okay. But separate it out to see there, you have the ability to put, even change that to development of a residential development under current zoning, right? So you could put 12 units to the acre there.
That's correct. Possibly. That's certainly not our intention. It wouldn't make any sense in the course of this project because we have to have the commercial in order to support the residential. It's a planned community, and if you build it just all residential, it wouldn't work. You wouldn't have the commercial to support the residential. So we certainly don't intend to do that.
You don't, but if you sold that parcel off, if the people who own this sold that parcel off, which I'm sure they will piecemeal off this,
they could, but
so
I think
big.
that would be subject to your subdivision and site plan ordinances, so you would have some ability to control that if they tried to parcel it off.
Well, it's already a single parcel. I mean, it's a separate parcel, right?
Parts of it, yes. There are parts of the commercially zoned. There are four separate properties in the development area.
Okay. I was just concerned why you didn't include it as a part of the RPC. Let me look through some of these notes. I made quite a few. On Todd, on your presentation, basically you have DNREC. Have they commented on all this stuff? It sounds great. Is anybody going to really do it? I mean, what requirements are there? Yeah, might as well come up. I mean, is there anything that requires this, all this study and all these plannings and all this scrutiny? And after it gets approved, can you somehow tell me this will continue?
Yes, the developer is committed to an ongoing active management program.
But my concern is these developments sell off so fast. They walk out the door and somebody else owns them. How do I know the next guy is going to have this kind of concern? Because in our county, all you got to do is submit that report, and then a lot of this stuff could get clear cut and get ignored, not the scrutiny you've applied to it, I guess.
Yeah, Todd Fritchman.
That's true, right?
Well, I want to answer the first question, and that was we are committed to meeting or exceeding Chapter 40, Title 7 of the Delaware Code relative to erosion and sediment control and stormwater management. And when I say exceeding, we're going above and beyond by incorporating native vegetation for biological removal of nutrients, habitat enhancement, and so forth.
But that's awful expensive, all the stuff you've been proposing. Now, nobody's going to require you to do that, correct?
It actually isn't that expensive when you incorporate the biological control methods. Your costs are very reduced. We're also meeting all the plus comments directly through this comprehensive management plan and addressing any and all issues that they have. We meet or exceed any and all their issues. We also are going to fully comply to all the Conservation District and the DENREC Division of Water Resources policies on, and also one I forgot that's very critical, we meet or exceed all the policies outlined in the Delaware Coastal Management Program for environmental enhancement and the what we call the green technology best management practices to employ in critical ecosystems and stormwater management.
But if they go out, if Darren sells this office piece or this piece or whatever, and somebody else has it, how do we know? Is there any guarantees that all this stuff you've just said will continue with a future owner? I got to do it now, or I got to. I mean, we had 2 hours.
You guys, got to
okay,
Mr. Cole.
Okay, quit. Tell them, be quiet down there.
For all of us, go ahead.
Mr. Cole, I think I can address that for you. As Todd has indicated, and this is Mr. Pardee for the record. Title 7, Chapter 40 has certain minimum standards that we have to meet by law,
right.
And so does your Sussex District Conservation District. So, that's the baseline by law that's required. What we're telling you is that we're committed to doing more. Can we guarantee you that if it gets sold, somebody else will do as much as we're going to do? No.
Could you put it in the conditions?
Sure.
You could do that.
Sure.
Are they in there now? They're not in there now. Any of that kind of work?
Well, there are a number of proposed conditions in terms of...
But the guarantee, like, for instance, monitoring required, and you're going to do quarterly inspections and all this stuff, that's not required by this minimal thing that the state requires.
That's correct.
This is over and above. Is it in anywhere in here? It sounds good, and it makes this presentation sound good.
Some of it is. We have in our proposed conditions covenants, requirements for homeowners association covenants to ensure that a lot of what we're proposing continues in perpetuity, and we've set up a guarantee of easements to ensure that that happens. But we haven't gotten to the specific level that you're talking about.
Well, I think it needs to be. Otherwise, it's subject to being lost in the shuffle.
Sure.
Okay. I just
One addition is that EnviroTech, as an environmental management service provider, is large enough and capable enough to handle the volume of this sort of project.
Yeah, I didn't question that. I'm just wondering if they'll keep you on after things get rolling and sales are slow. Todd, they got to cut somewhere. Might be your monitoring or something. Yeah, let's.
Mr. Cole, we don't want to speak for Mr. Lockwood or pin him in a box here, but I think it's his intention to retain a service like Mr. Fritchman's to maintain.
He does. He may. But he's been known to sell things.
Understood.
Things have been known to change out here. So I'm just trying to find out what kind of guarantees. It all sounds like a great presentation.
It's offered in a condition of approval, George.
That's what I'm trying to find. I haven't had a chance to read it all. It's so much I can't read it all.
Under P, under 1618.
Okay, all right. The guy, that's all right. I'm done, Todd. I'm just basically trying to, and I think I got what I need to know. The guy, Bruce and Brian, they basically, you haven't done many studies. Minimal studies have been done. And I think I read one of your, I think it was your letter, where it said they didn't want to overstate it, but anyway, that there was just, they haven't had a lot of information from you guys to be able to base a lot of the stuff on. Is that correct?
Right. At this point, we've done a preliminary, but it's consistent with the same level that would be done for on-site wastewater, Brian Carball, Artesian Resources.
Okay.
The level of study done at this point for spray irrigation is the site selection and evaluation report. It's the first set of studies. It's second part of tab 10.
I underlined that somewhere where his wording was cannot be overemphasized that the amount of soils work conducted to date is minimal, and it provides only a starting point. So it doesn't sound like a real great endorsement. It just sounds like
It's the first level of endorsement. Okay. The spray irrigation program works in essentially three steps: the site selection and evaluation report, the design development report, and the permit design. We've completed the site selection and evaluation report, had DNREC out to review that data. That's the level that they've done, and that's usually where we stop for preliminary and zoning approval. Once zoning approval is processed and approved, presumably, then we move on to the design development report, which does include more additional soils, but they've been out there. The soils look pretty good.
Big book, and you said a lot of things. I'm just wondering how much really is.
I hope that clarifies that. Okay.
If I could follow up on that, this is Mr. Pardee for the record. We're talking about 1,700 acres here, and I would think that common sense would dictate that 1,700 acres is more than ample space to handle the spray irrigation required, not only for this community, but for much more.
Okay, and traffic is basically, they're still waiting for the final traffic impact study so we can get a summary from DLDOT?
That's correct.
You know we're not going to look through that book.
I hope if you're having trouble sleeping, you might consider it. But you do have the preliminary. It's been approved.
But we don't have the ability to interpret it. You do know that.
Yes, sir.
Okay, right. And I don't think anybody in the county or our staff has really got the expertise that they have. So that's why we're waiting for a summary. So we don't have that yet. Do you expect that?
Yes, sir. We expect that. Carl, what would you say?
The study will be completed in the next couple of weeks and submitted to DLDOT for approval. DLDOT's approval can take approximately 6 months for a final traffic impact study.
Okay, for the record, that was Carl Wilson from the traffic group.
Okay, I mean, to me, that's important because this is pretty big, and there's a cumulative effect of all these developments, so I think DLDOT's looking at some of that when they're doing this. So, okay, that they're just, I'm just wondering if time is of the essence and if things are critical that we approve this real fast. And Mr.
If I could just speak just again, Carl Wilson, for the record. The letter that was submitted by DLDOT today basically says that DLDOT doesn't have an objection to the first 214 units being constructed. That's DLDOT's threshold for acquiring a traffic impact study. Anything below 214, they wouldn't require a study. So by the time the first 214 units get built, you know, first of all, this would have to go through a preliminary plan and the rest of the site approvals and everything. So that's why DLDOT doesn't necessarily have an objection to it moving through the zoning process at this time.
Well, yeah, unless if we can just limit it to 214, I think they have a problem if we approve 1,400 units or whatever it is, the number, 3,700 units.
Actually, if I may, this is Mr. Pardee. What they're saying to you, Mr. Cole, with all due respect, is they have no problem with you approving all 3,710 units for rezoning with the understanding that we can't actually construct any more than 214 until the final TIS is completed and approved. And we expect that to be done in 6 months. These first 214 units won't be built for 2 years at the earliest.
Okay.
If I may follow up real quick before I forget, and I apologize for interrupting.
I'm trying to do it as fast as I can.
I want to make sure you get answers to all your questions. You had asked earlier about whether there was any condition that we had proposed in our notebook that addressed the commitment for the Homeowners Association and perpetual maintenance, and that is, in fact, in the proposed conditions for all four of the rezoning applications, and it is proposed condition P, and that's for all four.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read, obviously. And Mr. Cronin, where is he? Where'd he go? There he is.
Mr. Cronin.
You never did say, is there too much supply or not enough supply? What was your conclusion? You gave us a lot of information about what was going on and told us we should know all this, but did you, because a lot of people think there's too much out there been approved. What do you think?
I'd say that there are a lot of people who want that supply, and therefore
who are those people?
The people who are moving into the county on a daily basis. Wait,
the current supply, you showed us the numbers.
Yes, sir.
Do you think that's high or low, the current supply we got?
You can only say something's high or low by also looking at the demand. The demand is very solid, especially on a long-term basis, and therefore the supply is not too much. Okay, if you had a lot of supply but nobody wanted it, well, then it's too much. If you had a lot of demand and no supply, then that would also be an imbalance.
In which direction are current sales going, up or down, or are they leveling out? What do you think?
I'd say at this point we're probably at the bottom of the real estate cycle in terms of residential demand. Okay, we, you know, a couple of years ago we're at the high point cyclically, then things got overheated, we're at the bottom now. And probably, you know, I would say this year we should be returning to more normal kind of sales and then probably rising a little bit into the future.
Okay, that's good.
Mr. Cole, if I may, just to give you some sense of perspective, and I'm trying not to say Kent County more than twice tonight, but their current inventory of homes is over 40,000 units in Kent County, and their market hasn't collapsed yet. And I would submit that the demand here in Sussex is much greater than it is in Kent.
I hope so.
That's the last time I'll say that.
Okay. You also said everything was in compliance with our county code. Do you? I saw some of these houses, the way they're laid out on lots in here. Is there going to be some Board of Adjustment requirements?
I don't believe so, sir.
Meets our...
Yes, it will, as proposed, will meet. And I would also point out that your MPHU ordinance gives you the flexibility. If you look at, it's Chapter 72, Section 72C says that the council is authorized to modify the provisions of the county zoning ordinance and planning and zoning regulations and processes as needed to achieve density incentives and specific design elements, i.e. minimum lot sizes and so forth. So you have the ability through your MPHU unit to entertain any variances that might be necessary without us actually having to go to the Board of Adjustment.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Is that right?
You have to ask that to your attorney.
Is that right? Somebody speak up, please, if you hear something's wrong.
Well, to address your overall, your initial question, although the MPHU ordinance does give some flexibility, the number of MPHU units may not cover all the lots that could be under our requirements. So there could be some need to go to Board of Adjustment. And by that, I'm speaking of the fact that typically in our RPCs, we require 60-foot width, I believe, and a 7,500-square-foot overall. Is that correct, Mr. Lank?
7,500 square feet, right.
Yeah. Well, they've got 299 lots at 6,500 square feet, which is 1,000 feet under. They've got 332 at 55 wide versus 60, and at 5,500 square feet overall. They've got 556 single family at 45 wide and 4,500 square feet. So if there were, for instance, 400 MPHU units, the number that I just mentioned of lots that are not as large as we typically require RPC, there's going to be some variances unless some different planning is done.
And we're certainly prepared to pursue those if necessary.
Okay. But I'd like just to know, because it's many times we sit here and we approve something and I didn't realize it was not in compliance, because then we run into, like with the fire marshal and other things. I rode through, I think it was Kentlands, in where is Gaithersburg, I guess it is, or something. One of those these beautiful communities that, it was dreadful, sir. The firemen, I sat next to a fireman. We couldn't even negotiate the bus. They took us in a tour bus. The buses couldn't negotiate the intersections. They were up on the lawns over the curbs because you couldn't make the radiuses and stuff like this. And then the streets were so close that the firemen said that, you know, the apparatus would be all under the thing, and then the fronts of the homes were so close it was a fire hazard. Now, they didn't like it. Now, you're saying that our fire marshal has looked at this plan and has signed off on it. We got anything from the fire marshal?
Not at this juncture.
I went over there and I just thought it was didn't do much for me.
Actually, that is addressed, Mr. Cole, in the plus comments, and certainly the development will have to comply with whatever the state fire marshal office.
But do all these streets, Lawrence? Do all these streets that they show in their pictures comply with our county ordinance?
We expressed some concerns about the units that have access to alleys.
Randall got a comment.
So
parking along alleyways.
So again, we may have another board of adjustment concern.
The part about the alleyways would be a concern.
No, the fire marshal will submit the plans to the fire department for review, and then we go through them and look at all the radiuses, the street widths, the parking, and we don't want that stuff with the bus. I mean,
did you go on that? You weren't on that bus with me.
No, but I know what you're talking about.
Was a guy from? I might have been from your fire company.
What are you talking about? Well, we look at we scrutinize
out
on every
one out of Route 9 was supposed to be there and didn't come. Anyway, they had a very difficult. I had the fireman that was with me was invited to go in there. He had a lot of critical things to say, which made a lot of sense. And I don't know if we need development that bad that we have to have streets where these buses, even the tour bus the guy had, he had to even laugh about it. He couldn't get it. You know, they couldn't make a corner. So I know how you like this kind of small stuff. And you know, years ago, Randall, you said a subdivision ought to have like 50% open space would be ideal. And this one's got, what, 30%? Or is it? Does it have 30%?
Randall, to return to that question, this has got about 35% within the developed area. And that is a very respectable type of percentage at this density. In fact, 50% is not enough if I'm designing it, say, one house per 3 acres or one house per 5 acres like Loudoun County, Virginia. I want 70% open space. The percentage of open space really is a sliding scale. If you're building at 5 dwellings to the acre, 35% open space is very respectable. And it's in my latest book called Crossroad Hamlet Village Town, talks about that kind of percentage of open space in a higher density development. In a very low density rural development, at 1 unit per 5 acres, you're looking for 60, 70% open space. I want to return to your question about the Kentlands. The Kentlands was done 15 years ago. I think there was a learning curve there. It was done in a different state. They would do things differently. I don't know of any new urbanist community that was done 10 or 15 years ago where they wouldn't do things a little bit differently in terms of the alleys or their turning radii. So we've learned from that.
But I don't know. I'm just trying to find out if we're in the same problem here with these.
We'll see. I don't think so. We'll see. Lawrence did circle one item, and that is an item that has passed muster in a lot of places, but it's new to Sussex County, and that's when homes directly front onto a village green. The street is out here, another 100 feet away, but there's a park in between, and there's an alley in the back. But there's no street frontage per se. The fire truck can park out here, it can park there, it can go down the alley, but the front of the lot fronts onto a park.
The narrowness of these alleys with these homes sitting on them seems to be the problem with some of the local firemen, but anyway.
Yeah, that will be addressed through the fire marshal comments.
Same question on page
11. Mr. Cole, for the record, this is Mr. Pardee. I just want to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about tonight is a rezoning, and obviously we're going to have to go through a lot more process before we get into these kinds of site-specific issues. But Mr. Davis, I think, has an answer to your question.
Okay, go ahead.
This is Sean Davis for the record. The alleys at or lanes at the Kentlands were designed and built at 15 to 16 feet wide. Okay, that's one of the reasons why they had the firemen probably had a very difficult time negotiating them. The alleys or lanes that we're proposing here will be a minimum of 24 feet wide in accordance with your code. Actually, the new standard is 20 feet wide, and fire trucks have been brought up and down those alleys ad nauseum. very, very successfully with the turning radii and everything that you get with a 20-foot wide. We're going to show here 24 feet wide. Okay. It's going to be a very different system than what you see at the Kentlands. In terms of the fabric of the community, it's probably going to be the same. In terms of the detail, it's going to be different because, as Mr. Arndt said, that was developed 15 years ago. It was an infant TND. We've learned a lot since then. And some of those are some of the specific standards that hopefully we'll address.
George, if you remember, Fire Marshal came in 2 years ago, and we got on the same page with him because we were not on the same page for a while here. And it was happening here in this county. The Chief Association came forward. We passed an ordinance to be on the same page as the Fire Marshal.
Right, right. I understand. I'm just sometimes when we approve these, this becomes a site plan.
Right,
right. It doesn't
not
change.
Final,
I think not because the Fire Marshal reviews it. And doesn't.
Well, I was hoping they would have reviewed it by now. But okay.
Well, it's the plus and the Fire Marshal has been reviewed.
Mr. Pardee, I'll give you a chance to respond to. I'm reading in my notes here from Mr. Lank. My first impression is this should be part of Milton. Now, I live down in Ocean View, but my first impression is this should be part of Milton because this subdivision is going to have a major impact on the services of Milton and, you know, on and on. Why are you not in Milton?
The simple answer is we tried, and we thought that it was going to happen that way. But the discussions that we had with them just didn't work out, and the detail is in our notebook. But bottom line is they tried to impose what I would call punitive fees on us for annexation and impact fees. And frankly, that killed the golden goose because what we were doing was offering to provide them with infrastructure to serve their community into the foreseeable future and beyond our community, beyond the town of Milton. And, you know, I don't want to point fingers necessarily, but I think that they had a golden opportunity and they squelched it.
It's under tab 25, Mr. Cole. It's under tab 25, their history of...
Oh, yeah, okay. And I just wanted to get, because they'll get up maybe and say something.
Yeah,
we don't
need to beat that to death.
Hear it and find out that it's, okay, it was basically the permits, punitive permits.
Correct. The fees and the impact fees and the annexation fees that they sought to impose just killed the project.
Okay. Anything else, Mr. Cole?
No, I can't think of anything right now. Probably could, but go ahead.
Okay, I don't want you to say that. Give you a chance.
No, it's all right. It's a lot of stuff here, Dale, and it's a shame we only have this one night and it's getting late and everybody's going to be in a hurry.
I totally agree. Mr. Phillips?
Nothing right now.
Mr. Rogers?
See, everybody shaking your head at Mr. Cole, but everybody has one. So he's asked a lot of the questions, but you said that the...
Everybody has one what?
Yeah.
Mr. Cole? Where, you got another one?
No.
Mr. Rogers,
you said that the entire presentation, PowerPoint, will be available to us.
That's correct, sir.
As long as the booklet, and so.
Yes, and we would ask that respectfully that be made a part of the record. I apologize that we didn't have that available for you tonight, but frankly, we were revising it all the way up until the last minute. So we'll make sure you have that in the record first thing tomorrow.
I think the presentation was well, and after we hear the public, we probably have some more questions.
Thank you.
Anything else, Mr. Rogers?
You can ask him then.
Is that all, Mr. Rogers?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Jones?
Well, Mr. Cole asked a lot of questions. I could see the C1. I see in your book, I read in the front tab, it said, why didn't you go with the CR, the new version, because that wasn't passed when you guys filed.
That's correct.
I saw where that was answered one of my questions. I see you have 400 homes that were moderate housing. In the phases of the 10 phases, do you have a number picked out, like how many per phase or, you know, that kind of number?
40 per phase.
So it'll be 10, 40 a year for the year. So, okay. And I read in the minutes where the prices, certainly Bill Gates and all those, you gave a range, but that will be in the...
Yes, sir.
...in those ranges. And, you know, I did have a question about the Homeowners Association taking over. And that question was answered by George with his question with Todd. And that's about all I have except for that I would like to ask. I do have one in the traffic study. George said, nobody's going to read that book. Not on this side of the book. I got to understand that. In your traffic study, do you I hope, do you make recommendations to DelDOT, or you just have to sit back and let DelDOT make a recommendation to you?
Carl Wilson from the traffic group, we absolutely do have to make recommendations to DelDOT.
That's a good thing.
Yes. Okay. Before we submit the study, we'll have each intersection working at either an acceptable level of service or mitigated, all-site impact will be mitigated. And basically what that means is that in the future condition in 2019, with all the background development, some of the intersections will be at failing levels of service without our development.
Right.
We're basically going to put improvements in there that is going to make everything better.
Turn lanes, lights, whatever, that's it.
Yes.
And will you guys, will this project be required to fund that, you think?
Yes, it'll be funded by this project and others in the area, yes.
Okay. It's going to get better. Can I quote you on that? Your name again was? When this is all done, traffic will be better?
DelDOT's not going to pay for it.
DelDOT's going to pay for it.
I want to, because the next time he comes, I want to remind him that he said that.
That's all I got, John. Thanks.
Improvements don't mean really getting better, I think, when you're talking about DelDOT.
Anything else, Mr. Really Jones?
I had a couple, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I guess then. We can allow you to speak.
He's going to vote this time, I think.
I just want to clarify a couple of things.
You're all going by his house.
On these four applications that are CZs, there are three different developer groups for the four applications. Are you proposing, when you talk about homeowners association, to have a separate homeowners association for each application area?
We're actually proposing to have a separate homeowners association for each neighborhood that will be governed by an umbrella homeowners association for the entire development. And I think our proposed conditions bear that out in the paragraph P that I mentioned.
Does it contemplate and address a master overarching homeowners association?
Yes, sir.
Because that would be much easier for the county to deal with than fragmented associations.
Correct. That's the exact question that came up in front of the Planning and Zoning Commission, and we agree. So we are, in fact, and we're committing here on the record tonight, that we're going to have a master homeowners association that will govern the entire community, and then it's our anticipation that underneath that umbrella, you'll have a separate homeowners association for each neighborhood, because the requirements and conditions in each neighborhood will vary somewhat.
And two of these four first applications are AR1 to C1, but your conditions and proposed findings contemplate that you will self-record restrictive covenants to the extent that the county can't impose conditions on the straight C1 zoning. I just wanted to remind you that anything that the developer proposes to record would need to be in place possibly before approval occurs. Otherwise, the county has no way to assure. You can record restrictions and make them self-dissolving if the application is not granted, but that's something to think about.
Sure. Yep. Let me, if I may, Jim, just follow up. Is it possible that you could impose a condition that requires what you're looking for in terms of the...
Generally, on a straight C1 zoning, no conditions. It's either approved or not approved.
Well,
condition.
I think what
within an RPC we
sure.
can. But.
Well, I think I hope what you have seen here tonight is that you have a developer from the local community who is committed to making a dream come true, and he's a young man who's not going anywhere away from the community. So, if you have ideas that you want us to consider in terms of particular restrictions, we're all ears and we'd be happy to try and incorporate.
I just wanted to point out that on a straight C1, we can impose conditions.
I understand.
The other thing I noticed was that the water plant does not appear to be located on the same site as the homes that it would serve. To that extent, I'm asking, why wasn't there a separate application for the water plant as there was for the sewer plant?
Honestly, because we didn't know exactly where we were going to place the water tower at the time that we made the applications, and we're not even 100% certain of the precise location even tonight. It was, frankly, our view, and we think there's a good faith argument to be made, that the placement of the water tower off-site is encompassed within our application for the sewage treatment plant as a public utility. But even were that not the case, I think you have some flexibility in your MPHU ordinance that would allow you to locate it there. And even if that's not something that you buy into, If it requires another conditional use, because it's a public utility and because this is an MPHU community, I think it could be fast-tracked. If we needed to come back with another conditional use to site the water tower, we're happy to do that. Frankly, it's a kind of a site planning issue at this point, but if you want to see another conditional use application, we're happy to do that.
That's all I have.
Jim, I got a legal question for you. On the last one, CU 1725, that's parcels that are not contiguous. They're scattered parcels. Why? I've always understood that there's a problem except getting an application. Now, I know when you've got parcels that are contiguous, you can kind of lump it together, but, you know, has a big plan. But these, you know, to take in parcels, scattered parcels like that under the guise of one application, I don't think is permitted, is legally accepted by, because I read in one of those legal things or something that's not approved or appropriate. So I'm just, my question is, if we have permitted it here, what's to prevent guys to do it with subdivisions, with houses, with anything? This is, I don't know how we can accept one application of scattered sites. We've never done it, but
I'd have
know.
To ask
we
Mr.
Have.
Blank it's whether we've ever done that before.
Well, that's not the question. Whether we did, if we did it, maybe it was a mistake. And I don't think it's...
I don't think there's anything in the ordinance that says that all must be contiguous. Mr. Lang?
There's nothing in the ordinance about being contiguous. If anything we've had has been possibly one of the Synagro applications, which was for application of sludge.
And that was more than one tract, I believe.
There were more than one tract.
Yeah. So we
and
have
I,
done
I
it.
I can't
before.
Say they were contiguous. There may have been a rail separation, a road separation. That they
yeah.
But it wasn't.
I mean, this is obvious. I mean, these aren't anywhere close to contiguous, some of them.
Well, the ordinance doesn't require that they be, and we have done it before where they're not contiguous.
And you don't think that's a problem?
Well, at the point
you
of
you don't think,
at
the, I'm just asking you as a legal.
Mr.
You
Cole,
don't think that's a problem.
I'm not going to give you a legal ruling. And
you're the lawyer.
And, but this is an open session. You know, you want a legal opinion? Let's talk about it
okay.
some other time.
All right. We're voting on each one of these individual. We're not voting on them all six at one time, Mr. Cole. Mr. Baker, any comments, questions?
I have one question. You noted that there's a surplus of wastewater capacity with a proposed treatment facility. Can someone elaborate on that or the amount?
I believe Mr. Carbaugh can answer that question.
Yes, sir. Brian Carbaugh from Artesian Resources. We do envision a wastewater treatment system and has been presented that way that will have capacity to serve other than the proposed Elizabethtown community from a wastewater management and planning and infrastructure standpoint. This project originally, as you heard, was envisioned to provide wastewater management for the town of Milton. The owner wishes to maintain a wastewater capacity to serve the town of Milton should plans ever change and that become a need of theirs, although I'm sure they'll tell you that is not their wish at this time. That may change.
Is there any details to that proposal that you're going to offer them some capacity? How much? I mean, is there anything in the conditions? There's going to be something reserved for the town of Milton?
Right now, the Elizabethtown project has a projected wastewater generation of approximately 1.2 million gallons, about the same as the water needs. the wastewater system has a minimum capacity of 3 million gallons, probably up to 6 million gallons as we complete our studies. So there's plenty of capacity there. That capacity can be offered wherever it is needed, should land use decisions, other municipal needs.
I think what we're saying is regionally. Is it being designed for regionally and equate that into EDUs?
regional, it's being developed regionally, and you're talking about 10 to 20,000 EDUs.
I think that's what we're looking for.
It's 3 right. to 6 million gallons.
So you got reserve capacity.
There's plenty of reserve
but
capacity.
Is that any of that reserve capacity reserved for the town of Milton, or was it just made part of this presentation to sound good, but is there anything in here that we can leave this room tonight and be assured that there's going to be some reserve capacity in whatever this proposed sewer system?
There's the equivalent of 4,000 units including the commercial converted to residential in the Elizabethtown project. there's at least 10,000 units of capacity in the proposed wastewater system. There is capacity for Milton. Will it stay there forever, reserved for Milton, if they say they don't want it? If other people want it, presumably not.
But there isn't any
for
time.
For the foreseeable future, okay. Yes.
But there's nothing in writing, no agreement with them.
No.
This is all just being proposed.
Right.
Okay. I just, you know, it made it
sound
like it was.
There's nothing Mr. Cole says the town of Milton wants it. They're saying it's there if they do, if they ask for it. They've been offered that once.
It's.
Okay. You've had your turn, Mr. Cole. Let's go.
I know, Dale, but
Mr. Pardee, one question, just sort of. The state says that they provide funding in level one and two only. What type of funding do you anticipate?
Absolutely none from the state. I mean, we're talking about private roads, and all the infrastructure is going to be developer provided. So we're not asking the state for any handout.
Disappointing, because I thought that's where they put all their money.
They don't have any to give.
Well, if they're willing to contribute, we'd be happy to talk about it.
Okay, I'm sure you would. Okay, thank you. Before we take comments, pro and con both, we're going to take about a 3-minute recess. We'll come back, and you will have an opportunity to speak in support or in opposition to it. And we'll do that in about 3 minutes. Recess.
Man, it's hot here.
Phew. It's been 3 hours.
Yeah.
You
never complain about
ask
hot.
Questions.
Did
you
have
guys
have
none.
Did you have any?
Did
you ask at all? You had no questions.
It would have been a blank slate, and I've been better hanging.
Yes.
You'll be all right.
I think we're best.